to mark International Day of Persons with Disabilities, the Israeli regime military tweeted a photo of its communications tower in Tel Aviv lit in purple. The Zionist regime military claimed that the gesture was in honor of people with disabilities in occupied territories and around the world. Twitter users quickly seized on the irony and hypocrisy by highlighting the Zionist regime's myriad crimes against Palestinians with disabilities. Earlier this week, an Israeli and Palestinian human rights group published a report exposing the Zionist regime's sham investigations into the killing and maiming of protesters during Gaza's Great March of Return. At least 223 Palestinians were killed during those protests, which began on March 30, 2018 and concluded in December 2019. 7 persons with disabilities were killed during the protest, according to Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group. A UN commission of inquiry found that the Zionist regime's snipers shot at persons with disabilities knowing they were clearly recognizable as such during the Great March of Return. Additionally, more than 13,000 Palestinians were injured during the protest, some 8,000 by live fire, about 2,400 by rubber-coated metal bullets, and almost 3,000 by tear gas canisters that hit them directly. B'Tselem and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights stated in their joint report recently. Those figures do not reflect the thousands more people injured from tear gas inhalation during the protest. Of course, of the persons wounded, 156 lost limbs, the rights groups state, adding, none of these cases were investigated. B'Tselem and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights described the Zionist regime's self-investigation mechanism as a smokescreen intended to deter the scrutiny of international criminal court. The tribunal in The Hague only pursues war crimes cases when states are unwilling or unable to carry out meaningful domestic investigations. The Zionist regime is unwilling to investigate abuses against Palestinians by its forces, and therefore the responsibility to ensure accountability for these violations now lies with the ICC, B'Tselem stated. Extrajudicial execution of Iyad Hallaq is an example. Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, has called for a war crimes investigation into the killing of Iyad Hallaq by the Zionist regime police in Al-Quds last year. Hallaq, 31, was walking to a school for persons with disabilities that he attended when he was gunned down. The Zionist regime has withheld surveillance camera footage from the area where Hallaq was killed and imposed a gag order on Hallaq family's lawyer to prevent information about court proceedings from being made public, according to Al-Haq. The Zionist regime systematically resorts to excessive use of force, including against Palestinians with disabilities. 10 Palestinians with disabilities were killed by occupation forces in the West Bank and Gaza in 2018 alone. Persons with disabilities were among the more than 250 Palestinians killed during the Zionist regime's 11-day attack on Gaza in May. Iyad Salha, who used a wheelchair, was killed in an Israeli regime airstrike on his home on May 19th. Amani Mahawish, Iyad's wife, who was 8 months pregnant, was killed along with their 2-year-old daughter, Nagam. Salha was among 6 people with disabilities killed during the offensive, according to Medical Aid for Palestinians, citing the Palestinian Medical Relief Society and National Society for Rehabilitation. The bombardment also affected several health and rehabilitation facilities, including 24 organizations working with people with disabilities, Medical Aid for Palestinians added. Some 3,000 people with disabilities were displaced within Gaza during the bombardment. Palestinians with disabilities experience severe difficulty evacuating civilian buildings under attack, increasing the risk of injury and death. Medical Aid for Palestinians noted earlier this year. Deaf people in Gaza had difficulty accessing information during those terrifying 11 days. I felt that I was in terrible danger whenever the house shook, Saadia Meghdad, who is deaf, told the Electronic Intifada earlier this year, adding, "But I did not know where the bombs were landing." Older people are also acutely vulnerable during the Zionist regime's attacks on Gaza, coordinated from Tel Aviv Military Command Tower, illuminated in purple. "Wars take a heavy toll on us," Ishaq al-Sayyid told the Electronic Intifada in July, adding, "They deprive us of any sense of comfort or safety. I am still in a state of anxiety following the May attack." The consulate said it was proud to be working with a Palestinian group to enhance the rights and inclusion of people with disabilities in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, however, the UK government has allied with the Zionist regime against accountability for all Palestinians, including those with disabilities, by opposing the investigation underway at the International Criminal Court, ICC. Karim Khan, a British national, began his term as ICC chief prosecutor in June. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that he hoped that the election of Khan and another Briton as a judge would help serve reform at a court. Human Rights Watch condemned Johnson's remark as a brazen assault on ICC independence. EU sponsors Solidarity Film Festival is another example in this regard. The UK isn't alone in its empty gestures toward human rights while helping the Zionist regime consolidate the prevailing situation of impunity. The European Union is sponsoring, along with various Zionist regime agencies, the upcoming Solidarity Film Festival in Tel Aviv that it says puts human rights at the forefront. Sponsorship of the festival is a rejection of the Palestinian call for a cultural boycott of the Zionist regime. The cultural boycott call is inspired by the global movement that helped end apartheid in South Africa. Meanwhile, the EU has yet to reject and condemn the Zionist regime's use of a draconian anti-terror law against six Palestinian human rights and social service organizations. Three of the groups, including Al-Haq, Al-Zamir, and Defense for Children International Palestine, are assisting the International Criminal Court's war crimes investigation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The cinematic where the EU-sponsored festival is to be held is a convenient 5-minute walk from the Zionist regime military headquarters in Tel Aviv. Presumably, Palestinian film fans in the West Bank will not be allowed to pass through military checkpoints to attend the Tel Aviv festival. That would be too much human rights and solidarity to expect from the Zionist regime and the EU.
Thank you. leak in paradise. Part 2.
Golf is important for bankers. It's a good place to talk to clients because no one is going to listen to you on the golf course. The high net worth individuals, you wouldn't meet them in the office. I worked in 8 secrecy jurisdictions, Cayman Islands, BVI, Bermuda, Guernsey, Jersey, Isle of Man, Mauritius, all of them had golf courses.
Elmer's a very conservative man. He comes from a very, very poor working class background. And he's made it into the heart of the Swiss establishment, into the financial sector. And he is, or was for years, extremely loyal to the financial sector. Unusually loyal, because he has made it out of nowhere to be a somebody. And therefore, I think it was a real shock to him when the system started to let him down, when it behaved badly. And then when he complained about that bad behaviour, when it ejected him. So I think he was completely unprepared to play this role of whistleblower. And it's taken him literally years to work out how to do it. And it's really only recently that he's understood how to do it by coming out publicly and trying to build alliances who can help him to get the truth out.
Bank Julius Baer hired lawyers in LA. And the lawyers in LA represent the Hollywood stars. They're very, very aggressive at trying to basically use abusive process to shut down publications. Their tactic was to spray out subpoenas, spray out legal demands, and move extremely quickly. So they had a court case without even us turning up, and a temporary restraining order was issued, which knocked off the WikiLeaks domain name for about 10 days.
As a grand finale, Elmer leaked the files of 2 big fish. The candidate for the presidency of Brazil in 2002, Rosana Sani, appeared as a beneficiary of the Coronado Trust based in Guernsey. She was forced to step down from the presidential race after police raided her company and found unexplained cash.
Rudy's business hasn't started up so well, and he's still struggling with it. So this is why I'm here, to earn some money for the family. I live with my mother-in-law, and we share a flat, basically. My social life is very limited. I work long hours, and I go back home late. I'm keeping my costs low and trying not to spend extraordinary amounts of money. What I earn here, about half of it goes back to Mauritius to support Rudy there. At the moment, I'm trying to find a flat for us to bring him back here. I'm now trying to solve a problem, basically, and keeping the family together in any way I can. It's not that I chose to do this. I'm just kind of putting back together a broken glass.
1 hour after this interview, the UK tax authorities were given a CD full of offshore banking data from the Standard Bank. Rudolf Elmer never knew if the data was used by tax authorities. Tax secrecy is just as untransparent as the sacrosanct banking secrecy.
There are very powerful organisations, by which I mean the majority of Swiss banks and British banks, that need to reassure their clients, that is tax-evading clients and criminal clients from across the world, that their personal affairs are absolutely secure and hidden behind banking secrecy legislation, not just banking secrecy legislation, but secrecy arrangements of tax havens in the Caribbean which use trusts and offshore companies.
During my investigation, I was contacted by a friend of Rudolf Elmer. He knows the Swiss banking community and Elmer's personal story very well.
My we that's why they went so bad against Rudy, because they don't want other Rudys. In the view of other employees of the Swiss banks, becoming a Rudy doesn't pay.
Flashback. After his dismissal from Julius Baer in the Cayman Islands in 2003, Elmer returned to Zurich, where he found a new job. With documents in his possession that were incriminating to the bank, he posed a threat to Julius Baer, and the bank hired up to 10 private detectives to watch him.
That's the house we were living in. They drove in this road with huge speed between 9 and 10 o'clock in the evening, and then they stopped the car abruptly here in front of the room where my little girl was. They drove in with a quite bit of speed to create that terrible noise, and then they drove back again. So, and that happened not only once, it didn't happen twice, it happened several times, and I can recall, I would say at least about 10, 12 times, there were times when it happened three evenings in fall, or for them 2 days nothing at all, and so on. So we didn't really know what we have to expect. Stalking is, from my point of view, a crime, especially if you go after family members, after children, after neighbors. I mean, it's not one neighbor, it's another one, it's another way, down there, everyone. So it's a huge number of people who felt afraid. They drove me mad. Yeah, I was mad, to be honest. I was mad at certain points in time. Luckily, I wasn't that mad that to take any terrible action and, let's say, using a gun or anything else. I just thought, if I can stop them, here, calling the police. Because every time when it happened, the police was, unfortunately, too late. I prepared a piece of wood, put nails in it, put that on the street, lying in on the meadow there, and waiting until those guys come and pull the piece of wood over the road to hurt their car, car. And then that was interesting. I mean, it was interesting that my daughter came and said to me, Papa, mm-hmm. what are you doing here? And then I said, okay, I lost myself again. I'm driven by action, not by logic. Today I know how to drive people mad. Yes. If you do have the money and put constantly a little bit more pressure here, a little bit more pressure there, on the employees in your office, then on your family, your daughter, then I was close. I mean, I was thinking about suicide. I was thinking about taking action against those stalkers, or taking an action against key people in the bank, because I knew Raymond Baer was behind it. He knew what was going on. I knew Mike Baer was behind it. I knew Thomas Baer. Those were the guys who could have said, we stop that action. But they must have said, go on. Go on with the action, make this guy, as the head of resources told me, finish him up.
This intimidation by private detectives took place in 2004 and 2005. At that time, Rudolf Elmer and his family repeatedly filed complaints against X for harassment, but the Zurich prosecutor systematically refused to open an investigation. Rudolf Elmer then responded using the means available to him by sending his data to the Swiss tax authorities and a financial magazine.
The journalist just chose to do nothing. I mean, he didn't investigate the data. He just broke the story that the data were stolen, and that's it. Only 4 years later, when a similar CD was handed over to The Guardian, they investigated the data. They wrote about the clients, about high net worth individuals, about tax avoidance, about money laundering, all the things that 2005 weren't done.
A few weeks later, the media group Ragier, which owns Cash, covertly handed a copy of the CD to the bank.
why did they give the CD to the bank in the first place? I mean, what about the protection of the sources? That's exactly the argument they used, not to hand over the CD to the prosecutor. So either you protect your sources from the bank and from the prosecutors, or you don't protect your sources, and then you have to hand over the CDs to everybody.
When the cash story broke, Julius Baer filed a complaint against X for breach of banking secrecy. Quickly, things are closing in towards Elmer.
Basically, what happened is I went to work, was called by a policeman, and he told me that something is wrong with my daughter, I should come home quickly. I left the office at 9 in the morning again, back to Freienbach, and then there was the police in my house. They just said they're performing a house search, and they take me now to custody.
After 2 weeks in custody, Rudolf Elmer's lawyer called for his release. The Zurich justice system then produced a document of a dubious nature.
Hello. My name is David Leloup. I am a Belgian journalist. And I am preparing a story about Rudolf Elmer. Do you know Rudolf Elmer?
No.
The prosecutor used your name.
My name is Yolanda.
Yes. To testify against him. You don't know him. Because here it's written that you are his wife.
Nein. I don't know. I don't understand it. My name, yeah.
You are not the wife of Rudolf Elmer.
No.
This false evidence against Rudolf Elmer was apparently due to a copy-paste error by the Zurich Department of Justice. It was nevertheless used, along with other arguments, to keep Elmer in custody for another 2 weeks.
After the imprisonment, I had two meetings with the bank, and a representative of the bank made an offer to settle the problem, and it was a payment of around 500,000 Swiss over 5 years, every month a little portion, an installment, and then at the end some lump sum. But basically it meant over 5 years, and the idea was just that I stay quiet for those 5 years. Now what they wanted from me was that I do accept that agreement, and all the complaints they had against me would be solved.
But Rudolf Elmer saw this offer as a means of buying his silence. So he turned it down and went into exile in Mauritius.
Future crisis will identify jurisdictions that fail to cooperate, including tax havens, and take action to defend our financial system.
We have agreed that there will be an end to tax havens that do not transfer information on request. The banking secrecy of the past must come to an end.
Hello, here is Mr. Berger. I would like to have some advice on a trust issue. I'm Swiss-American and need some advice how to set up the structure or move the structure.
Yeah, sure. If you want to give me a better idea of what you're looking for, I can give you some better advice.
Yeah, I do have a Cayman Trust who holds a Swiss account, has a Swiss bank account. I'm a bit afraid of to keep the money in Switzerland. Are there options?
Well, the country that does not not cooperate with either Switzerland or the United States. They're very difficult to get any information out of is Guatemala. They don't share any information based on any tax cases, even if it's criminal.
All right.
Guatemala is very secure.
But in Guatemala, are there banks like well-known banks like HSBC or call it Credit Suisse or Deutsche Bank?
Yes, there are. There's one bank in particular. I can't give out the name of the bank until you're a paid client, but it's on the same level as HSBC or Credit Suisse. What we need for the bank account would be a notarized copy of your passport.
And would it be possible to have kind of a hold mail agreement with the bank? That, I mean, I don't really want that the information is sent out to, let's say, over the bound to another country.
Yeah, no. You're protected by bank privacy laws of Guatemala. It would be illegal for the bank to release any information on you.
All right.
You have all ownership of the company, but the lawyer will appear for you in the public registry.
That's called kind of a nominee, huh, isn't he? Then
that's right.
Yeah. Oh, all right. That sounds good. Yeah. And how much would it cost such a structure?
We charge $4,000 for the company and the bank account in Guatemala.
That's all in all.
All in all.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, that's very reasonable.
The offshore banking system emerged from the financial crisis stronger than ever. Once again, Rudolf Elmer looked for a way to rock the system.
Mr. Rudy Elmer, please welcome him to discuss his story, his case, and the issues it raises. Thank you, sir.
Good morning. I would like to tell you the short story first about what happened to me, and then the second part will be then about the real matter. Now, the short story is, and it's a very simple one, I was in the Cayman Islands, and there was a kind of a mouse tail. Mouse tail. I started to pull on it a bit, and it got bigger, the tail. It looked like dragon tail. I went back to Switzerland. I started to pull on it more. I didn't stop. And it got bigger and bigger. It became a dragon. A dragon, a fire-breathing dragon with several heads. And one of the heads was the bank. One was the press, one the Swiss press up to a certain extent. Then the prosecutor, and all were after me and my family to put pressure on us.
Basically, in 2008, having exhausted the routes he sought through the bank and the Swiss courts, Mr. Elmer went to WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. Thank you for coming.
Mr. Elmer has been fighting his case for some 5 years, I believe, to, in one way or another, draw attention to this data. Of course, we don't know whether he is our source or not. We are structured in such a way that we do not know that. However, he certainly has something important and has had something very important to say about this matter. And I understand he is in a position to have more to say and more to give to the world to help them understand these sort of corrupt practices.
This data has been collected due to my whistleblower website having had contacts with other people. I will not reveal any company names. I will not reveal any high net worth individuals. What I want to do is to hand this over to WikiLeaks. And I say that again, WikiLeaks, in order to have it investigated and making a decision on it. It's a similar thing as the first whistleblower letter I wrote.
And together to the front, guys.
can't say more than that.
The Guardian did mention 40, as many as 40 politicians were possibly involved in this. Can you state that possibly we're talking about 40 politicians?
I made that statement, so I can state it, yes.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., more than one in four adults was suffering from a diagnosable mental disorder even before the pandemic. For too long, cost and access barriers to mental health care have caused incalculable suffering. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Lynn Parmore, writer. This article is titled, "The Pandemic is Exacerbating an Already Dire Mental Health Crisis in U.S." Stay tuned for more. Devastating conditions like major depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and obsessive-compulsive disorder are among the leading causes of disability in established market economies, according to Johns Hopkins Medicine. In the U.S., more than one in four adults was suffering from a diagnosable mental disorder even before the pandemic. For too long, cost and access barriers to mental health care have caused incalculable suffering. COVID has now blown the lid off a crisis building for decades. The Lancet reports that cases of mental disorders have skyrocketed during the pandemic, including 53 million new cases of major depressive disorder and 76 million new cases of anxiety disorders. In the U.S., since the spring of 2020, the National Center for Health Statistics has partnered with the Census Bureau on a new rapid turnaround data system to monitor depression and anxiety. finding that just over half of adults between the ages of 18 and 44 surveyed have reported symptoms, as have 38% of adults living with children. Researchers find that younger adults, racial and ethnic minorities, essential workers, and unpaid adult caregivers, most of them women, have been especially hard hit by mental distress and increased substance use. Growing alcohol use is particularly worrisome among stretched to the breaking point young women juggling children under the age of 5 and work responsibilities. Feedback loops within families mean that distressed parents transfer their anxiety and depression to children and vice versa. Three top U.S. organizations specializing in child and adolescent mental health, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, recently declared a state of emergency for the country's youth, noting that COVID-19 and the ongoing struggle for racial justice have compounded trends of declining mental health among kids observed prior to 2020. Many people in the U.S. find themselves in so much pain they think about dying. Suicide attempts by young girls are notably on the rise. Young people in the U.S. are unable to obtain mental health care and are being sent to hospital emergency rooms where the staff are under their own intense stress due to private equity takeovers of health care and the spillovers of an inadequate care system. Yet, as alarming as it all sounds, signs indicate that the crisis may only intensify. COVID-19 case rates may be falling in some areas, but the stresses associated with the pandemic are far from over, particularly as new variants spread, causing further disruption. In the United States, those needing help face a serious shortage of mental health specialists, themselves often suffering from burnout and stress. A reduced number of psychiatric hospital beds, and a loss of job-based health insurance. Even for those who have insurance, a lack of in-network counselors and therapists mean that care is frequently out of reach. And if you don't live in a city, you may be out of luck. In some states, 80% of the population lives in an area where mental health professionals are scarce. The upshot is that millions are going without the treatment they require. People are unable to sleep, gaining weight, and turning to potentially harmful strategies as they struggle to cope with grief, loss, isolation, family and workplace stress, and economic woes, including the latest worries about inflation. The coronavirus itself attacks the mind. The infected may experience psychological symptoms like brain fog, and for more, the virus is nowhere near done with them after the initial infection. Long haulers face a nasty list of potential psychiatric disorders from phobias to anxiety. Some estimates suggest that as many as 1 in 5 people infected with COVID experience such disorders within 3 months. They get better, then they get worse, then they get better, up and down on a hellish roller coaster. That's not all. Research has shown that those recently diagnosed with a mental disorder were significantly more likely to contract COVID, and they tended to have worse outcomes than people infected who didn't have a mental disorder. Researchers now suspect that having schizophrenia is second only to advanced age as the highest risk factor for dying of COVID. Nobody knows exactly why. Viruses have long been linked to mental illness, though just how they relate is not well understood. As early as 1732, clinicians noted that the flu often came with symptoms like neuroarthritis, melancholy, hysteria, mental frustration, and insanity. When COVID hit, researchers looked back at the impact of the Spanish flu and other pandemics on mental health. Like wars and other devastating events, pandemics produce a wide range of mental health issues that hit poor and vulnerable groups especially hard. COVID is no exception. Researchers Anne Case and Angus Deaton brought the term depth of despair into public awareness with their studies of how mortality rates had risen sharply among certain populations since 1990s. Their work has highlighted how the impact of stressors tends to widen the gap between haves and have-nots, already affecting the U.S. and other countries. The costs of mental illnesses are staggering in human suffering and in dollars. In the United States, 10% of insured people make up 70% of total spending on healthcare. Of that high-cost group, more than half are seeking treatment for behavioral health. Mental health spending is rising twice as fast as overall medical spending. Shockingly, nearly half of people seeking treatment for mental distress get the wrong diagnosis.
Simple question.
Who's really responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? The recent drowning of at least 27 migrants has led to renewed calls for a new approach to the ongoing crisis caused by those trying to start a new life in the United Kingdom. While British government officials claim it is on track to fix the broken asylum system, legislation has been criticised for making it harder for those arriving by boat to claim asylum in Britain. Those who speak for refugees even say the new proposals are actually cruel.
There's a pattern to the problem. A large proportion of these migrants come from Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. All countries torn apart by conflict supported or even started by Anglo-American military escapades. Furthermore, while the UN Refugee Agency says deaths can be avoided with coordinated action, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron have fallen out after the French President objected to Mr. Johnson's accusations that France has not done enough to stop migrants crossing the channel. The impact of these political and military conflicts has turned out to be lethal. War and conflict disrupt countries and entire regions, forcing migrants to flee. In their desperate efforts to start a new life, some pay traffickers large sums to assist them in their efforts to cross the channel to England. This leads to illegal immigration, increasing tensions between France and the United Kingdom, and deaths in the sea, while France and Britain blame each other for the migration issue and the human toll of those who drown.
To what extent is the UK responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? And who should be creating a new place for people to live after escaping from war-torn conflicts in which the United Kingdom plays a part? Simple questions with important answers. And we begin our inquiry with a straightforward and direct question. What does the public think of the deaths of 27 migrants who drowned while trying to cross the channel? We put that to the public here in London. This is what they told us.
A boat which is about the size as that one that goes up and down the river here, the small one. 27 people were on it, and it capsized, and they drowned this last week. And they just drowned, and their bodies were washed up on the shore. Yeah.
It's so sad to hear that. Yeah, I mean, things like that should not be happening in the future, of course.
It's an absolute tragedy, and I just wish that there were actually legal safe routes for people to get to Britain in order to claim refugee status.
The way that we talk about, you know, helping people and things like foreign aid, but when there's real issues like people trying to escape persecution, I think it's shameful that the government, you know, practically ignores or tries to deflect the problem.
I mean, it's just a shame, really, isn't it? I mean, it's upsetting when anyone dies, let alone migrants. I mean, there's the whole... I'm sure an overwhelming majority are just trying to escape what can be just explained nothing short of an absolute travesty.
Sad and disappointed.
I don't think that's very nice to hear at all.
They have family, they have mother, father, sons, daughter, and I think we or the government need to pay the attention in that case.
I think it's a terrible tragedy. I don't think anyone deserves to die when trying to gain freedom and have the rights that we should all be given as human beings upon this earth.
Well, obviously, wasted life is always a tragedy, but it would not happen if people didn't get on broken lilos and try to cross the busiest waterway in the world in treacherous weather.
Horrific, and why don't we have a secure way whereby these people fleeing from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria are able to come to this country? I think we've opened the doors to, is it 3 million from Hong Kong? Why can't we find a humane, civilized way of helping these people?
It's very sad. It's sad that they have to move, like, come over here and try and find, like, obviously living over here. Like, it's sad that they have to do that, like, rather risk their life than just trying to find a better life where they actually are. I don't know, it's quite sad.
French government is responsible first because that's their border. And then the British government should taking care of their English waters or English Channel to control the border. I think nobody should risk their life for better life.
It's terrible. It shouldn't have never happened in the first place. I mean, they should just have safe passage to prevent this to start with.
First, I suppose, use the word tragic, and it is a tragedy.
Obviously, I think everybody can be completely sympathetic to the situation. And yeah, of course, I think everybody was greatly saddened by the situation, considering there were children involved as well, which makes it even worse.
Many are refugees from conflicts fought by Britain, including in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other Middle Eastern countries. In the public's view, what responsibility does the UK have for these deaths?
I think we have a responsibility to provide safe passage for people to come here to attempt to claim refugee status. If we feel that we have the right to go and intervene in different ways around the world, then we have the responsibility to kind of follow up the results of that, I think.
Oh, we have massive responsibility. You know, it's anything that, you know, is initiated or guns that we sell to different parties in these conflicts is entirely, you know, the British government's responsibility to do something about it.
There's a very, very valid argument to make that to a certain extent, intervention in certain countries has worsened political situations. I mean, the arguable thing, you know, you can look at situations like maybe Syria or Iraq, Afghanistan is a very good one, I think.
I think we're responsible if we're involved in the conflict, but we're also responsible as a better-off country to help people who are not safe.
It's hard to pinpoint the exact responsibility if the conflict that they're running from is caused by the UK or at least contributed to by the UK. There's definitely some responsibility there, in my opinion anyway.
Well, this should be something that maybe the governments of the world should look at, and those of us who have more to give should be able to give and allow safe haven for these people.
I think we do have some responsibility for taking our fair share of refugees from conflicts that we've had a part in.
They're mainly refugees from countries which have internal problems, and that's why there was influence from the British. And there are a number of countries that they could have stopped in along the way if they truly wanted somewhere that was just safer than where they came from.
These crossings are a consequence of us so-called global Britain meddling around in the Middle East, so we have a lot of responsibility.
I don't really know who to blame, but I'm pretty sure both sides should be responsible, like both France and the Britain part. Because is there a kind of shared channel, I guess? So.
There's some implicit responsibility because, you know, we've armed these countries, we've been involved militarily, and we haven't supported some of the kind of the transportation of the immigrants in the first place that were suffering in these countries.
That's a very loaded question. I think, obviously, they travelled many miles to get to the UK. Clearly, I think there's a lot of discussion about being housed in the first port of call of whichever country they go to. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that situation, but I guess if they do get to the UK, they're entitled to a hearing. They're entitled to the civil liberties, and obviously they're entitled to actually put their case forward. And that's the problem. I don't think they do get that. And perhaps the UK needs to have a rethink on that point.
Yes, some days ago, also, I heard about the problem in Afghanistan. I think that's something that is impossible to think in the 25...
French police have been seen to watch on as many refugees board boats to cross the channel. What do people here in Britain think of the French allowing migrants to make these hazardous crossings?
The French police have watched on. They've been filmed watching on while the traffickers send the boats across. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's difficult because that's a tough one, because if they stop them, then they stop them being able to try and find somewhere safer. But at the same time, it's not a safe journey either. But I don't know, that's a tough one.
From a legal perspective, it very well could be justified. From my opinion, that doesn't come across as right.
Yeah, I wish that there was closer and better tempered and more even collaboration between Britain and France and between Britain and the rest of the EU. Over this, to be fair, it's obviously not ideal that people are being allowed to launch themselves into small, unsafe boats into the channel. We've seen the result of that this year, so I wish that wasn't happening.
If we start the war, obviously we should be taking responsibility for it. So, I mean, yeah.
The entire international community needs to take some responsibility and work together, like I say, to try and find a solution.
If you're seeing somebody getting on a boat that you know is probably not going to make it, I mean, in my opinion, I would be saying, don't make that crossing.
I think it's a responsibility of the French government.
Didn't see them to know if that's true or not. If it is, then they should be held accountable, but I haven't seen any evidence either way on that.
It's a very complex issue, I think. It's wrong of them to not intervene, although there's always circumstances around everything. But I think there's always a duty of care to people, no matter who or where they come from.
I can't understand how we haven't taken back control from the French police.
I think that's part of the reason why they want to come over here, because they're just not getting looked after very well, clearly, either. If they're getting allowed to get on the boats, causing tragedies, and they're allowing it to happen. We're trying to stop it, and they're allowing it to happen and allowing them to come while we're trying to stop.
I think British government, to be honest, because if you get involved in someone else's business, then there is always the consequences, so you have to face the consequences.
Basically, it's wherever they seek in, whichever country they look at to find asylum, that's where they should be housed in the first place.
I think what I probably would like to say, you wouldn't want to repeat, but I think that's absolutely disgusting. Clearly, if it's on the shores of the UK, we would expect the police to do their duty, and I think the same thing should apply to the French police.
The statistics underline the size of the issue and how little Britain is really doing to fix it. The Home Office plans to accept 5,000 people in the first year of the Afghan Citizens Resettlement Scheme, and up to 20,000 more afterwards. However, by late November 2021 alone, it is estimated that during this year, over 26,000 people, many from Afghanistan, had already arrived in small boats after crossing the channel illegally. Yet the Afghan conflict, in which the UK played a central role, generated 2.5 million refugees, of whom 2.2 million live in Iran and Pakistan, showing how small the UK's contribution is to fixing the problem it helped cause.
Who should be held responsible for finding new homes for refugees escaping conflicts fought by Britain?
I think a lot of responsibility therefore comes onto the government to make sure that we can give safe passage to these refugees and we can allow them in and look after them as the conflict is our fault.
I believe they should have handled the issue like in a more precise manner.
Just because that's the country they went in first doesn't mean that country has equal responsibility for them being a refugee in the first place.
We're partly responsible and countries should work together. Unfortunately, we seem to be global Britain going it alone, but we should work, like with the health crisis on COVID, countries should work together to solve these problems, be it climate change, refugees. It's a shame that we don't have anyone with any diplomatic skills from Lord Frost, Rab, Priti Patel, Boris, to make sure we are responsible global citizens.
It should be a shared effort between more governments, I'd say Britain, France, and whoever participated in that, in those wars. That would seem fair to me.
Allow them to make the crossing. Letting people make something that's unsafe where they could possibly lose their lives is almost like a criminal act. They're complicit in the deaths in a way by letting that happen. Yeah.
Well, again, I think it's down to probably every country to do their part. And we hear all the figures on the media. You never know whether you're hearing the right figures or not. Fairly obviously, I think other countries in Europe probably have taken more than the UK, and possibly the UK need to rethink their policy in that respect.
Who's actually responsible for rehousing people who have been victims of conflict that Britain itself has led or been involved in?
I think if people have refugee status in Britain, then Britain is responsible for rehousing them. We shouldn't forget that Britain has, I think, around about 1% of the world's refugees here. We have a tiny, tiny percentage of the world's refugees, and if we want to see ourselves as global Britain, as a country that has a role on the global stage, then we need to step up and take responsibility for some of this.
I would not like to comment on that, yeah, but these things should not be happen. I mean, if they are watching it, they should have stopped it, of course.
I don't want to just pile blame onto my own government. It's obviously the responsibility of all governments to try and find a solution for these people.
But it is our responsibility as humans, as common man, to account for one another. So not just the government, but we all, as a collective, need to step up and do something about it.
My opinion is, rather than trying to figure out exactly who is responsible, is that if you feel you can do something, and as a country, if we feel we can do something, then we just should.
What is the public's advice to the British government about refugees who risk death in the process of trying to cross the channel?
I think these practices should be stopped. I mean, force measures should be taken to stop it, because if the people are trying to cross the channel, they can lose their lives. So, yeah, of course.
My advice to government would be to work with people, with our friends and colleagues in the EU, to step up and to act more humanely, to give people safe passage routes.
If the government wants to, you know, be re-elected, they need to take action and do something about it.
There are plenty of people in the country who would want to help. It's just reaching out and maybe putting together a system where people who can help and can provide housing, or even if it's just temporary, you know, there's a lot of people with spare bedrooms.
Everybody knows it's an issue, and it's been an issue for quite some time. My advice would be stop ignoring it. Do something.
Let's try and find a way where they don't have to risk death, and we can help them if it is that we're responsible.
Oh, I think, Britain can help people who are homeless to find homes and so on.
I would say it's a very complex situation, but human life has to be saved amongst anything else. But I think rather than spending so much time trying to dissuade people from crossing, we should look at the reason why the people are going in the first place.
Work with other countries.